And welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Shirley Min, in for Cherry Gregg. Coming up this hour, we're going to talk about green energy and how the U.S. can reach the goal of net zero emissions by 2050. So what clean energy combinations will get us there? We're going to look at wind, solar, geothermal, carbon capture, and some even more far out ones.
Far out.
Far out. So what are the trade-offs that we have to make to reduce our carbon footprint?
And then later in the hour, we have an interview that Cherry did with an author, Jane Wong, about her memoir, Meet Me Tonight in Atlantic City. It's about her family's Chinese restaurant and growing up in the shadow of all of those glitzy casinos.
Sounds like a good one.
First, we're going to talk some news. I'm going to acknowledge off the top, Shirley, that it's the summer solstice today, longest day of the year here in Philadelphia. 15 hours and 1 minute of daylight. Oh. Don't waste a moment of it, Shirley.
I love it, but it's only a moment.
It is a moment. It took me a while, deep into adulthood, to realize this, that the actual summer solstice is a moment in time. Mm-hmm. It's when the sun is 90 degrees above the Tropic of Cancer, which happened at 10:57, yeah, just over an hour ago. So the summer solstice happened, say that five times fast, and we are now in official summer, not meteorological, right, summer, but astronomical summer. Happy summer, Shirley.
Happy summer, Avi.
And we're going to start with some happy news today. Or I don't know if it's happy, but it's sort of light at least.
Yeah.
It's a cookie development. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Insomnia Cookies. Insomnia Cookies. Many of you might know this company. It's a chain of cookie stores. That's what they sell. They just sell cookies, mm-hmm, and some ice cream now. It was founded in 2003 by a Penn student who was dissatisfied with the late night options. So they created this cookie store that's open in the middle of the night. There are now 240 locations. And the Inky, I believe, had the cookie scoop this morning, which yeah, you're already sick of me. cookie scoop this morning, which is that they're going to be going international. They're going to be Insomnia Cookie locations in the greater Toronto area and Manchester, England.
I mean, I love that a Philly company is going abroad and, like, we're really expanding the,
yes,
Philly footprint.
But
I've never had these cookies.
Oh, you've never had them?
No. And I understand it's Insomnia because they're delivered late night.
Yeah.
I always thought there was caffeine in them. So that's why they were called Insomnia?
You thought they were Red Bull cookies?
I did.
No.
So
well, there's sugar in them. I suppose that would keep you awake. No, I don't think, unless I'm not familiar with the menu anymore, I do not think there are caffeine in Insomnia cookies.
No, I don't think they are.
But this is a trend, I feel like, sort of a gourmet, cookie-focused establishments. Mm-hmm. There's that place, Crumble Cookie. Have you ever been there?
Yeah, I haven't. I'm not a big cookie person. Let me just put that out there.
We led off with a story that is just way outside of your bailiwick. You hate cookies. Got it. So Shirley.
Don't hate cookies. Just not – that's not my late night food go-to.
Got it. But you are happy that Insomnia is enjoying success.
I am very happy, and I like that they're promising to stay true to, like, the company's Philly ties, the Philly roots. And
they're opening up, like, a flagship location in Center City that's going to have, like, a bakery and other sorts of experiences as well. So looking forward to that. Now let's take us to Delaware now, Shirley.
So this is a new one. So as of today, when you go to the DMV in Delaware, whether it's to get a new license or renew it or change your name or address or something like that, and you are not already registered to vote – and your citizenship is confirmed, you're going to be automatically registered to vote.
Mm.
So this is often referred to as, like, motor voter.
That's good branding.
Because it's affiliated
with
the DMV, right? So the new voters are automatically registered without a party affiliation. But after the fact, you're going to get a letter in the mail that you need to kind of confirm, okay, yes, I want to be registered. And if you do, then you can choose a party. And I only say this because Delaware is what's considered a closed primary state.
Right,
so if you want to
be
able to vote in a primary, you do need to choose a party. But again, as I mentioned, this is like an opt-out policy. So if you really are not interested in the automatic voter registration, you can opt out of it. But I mean,
this seems like a common sense policy.
It really does. It really does.
But it's 22 other states and D.C. now have something similar.
Yeah.
Pennsylvania, not among them.
No. New Jersey is
among them. Mm-hmm. So now two of the three states in our region will have this opt-out motor voter type of policy when it comes to voting, which just seems like a way to expand access, remove a hurdle, encourage people to vote. I mean, it doesn't seem like there's a ton of downside here.
No. I mean, whether this increases turnout, that remains to be seen. But
Exactly.
All good here.
And before we get to our newsmaker interview, Shirley, I just wanted to kick it back over to you because we wanted to acknowledge something that was in the headlines today briefly.
Right. So we're all kind of following what's going on with the search for the Titan submersible that was looking at the Titanic and how it's gone missing. So we have learned today that there is a local tie with this story. And the one of the passengers is a graduate of Philly University. He was on board the submersible. And he was on board. It was Shahzada Dawood and his son, Suleiman Dawood. Yeah. They are on board that submersible. The Dawoods are part of a prominent Pakistani business. And I don't know. It's just, this is such a heavy story. Yeah. And I feel so much. Shahzada had earned a master's of science degree in global textile marketing from Philadelphia University. And Philadelphia University, I think,
is now Thomas Jefferson University. So we don't want to extrapolate too much on this, speculate too much about it. Just want to note that local tie, because obviously this is an ongoing scenario. It has the attention of the world at this point.
I'm gripped.
We're here waiting for the conclusion, like all of you. So we'll keep you up to date. Going to bring it closer to home now and talk about I-95, where we've been talking about a lot recently. Mm-hmm. Going to read a quote first. This is what it looks like when the ingenuity of Delco meets the grit of Philly. So said Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro yesterday when he announced that a critical portion of I-95 would reopen this weekend, which is amazing.
It's crazy.
That Delco part of the quote refers to an unusual type of material crews are using right now to create a temporary fill that will support the reopened lanes. This fill is made by Aero Aggregates, which is a company based in Eddystone, Delco. And joining us now on the line is the company's founder and CEO, Archie Filshill. Archie, thanks so much for joining us on Studio 2.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Archie, people think when they hear that they're going to be driving over recycled glass or some kind of material made from recycled glass, I think they think they're driving over like shattered beer bottles or something, or shattered pieces of glass. But I know that the material kind of looks like a pumice stone and it's super lightweight. How do you turn this recycled glass into this material that's very light and like a pumice?
Well, you're exactly right. When you say recycled glass, people have a picture in their head of broken bottles, but that's what we start with. We take the glass that nobody else wants or otherwise would go to landfill, and we bring it to Eddystone and we put it through several processes. One is a cleaning process to take any of the paper and plastic out. But then we take all that mixed colored shards of glass and we grind it into a very fine powder, almost a talcum powder consistency. Then it goes through a heating process that foams it. So we are taking it from shards of glass and really creating a new material, an engineered material out of it.
What's the history of this process? Like, how long have people been doing this? How did you get involved in producing this type of material?
Sure. So, my background's in geotechnical engineering. And for about 15 years, I had a design build construction company that worked pretty heavily in the Delaware Valley. And we saw the need for lightweight increasing, a lot of soft soil sites, a lot of work around the water, around the Delaware and the Schuylkill. And previous to Aero, your only option was big blocks of expanded polystyrene, or what they call geofoam. But the geofoam has some issues because it's flammable. And if you spill gas or diesel, it melts. So not great for under highways. You have to take a lot of precautions. And I was introduced to foam glass by a colleague in Norway back in 2013. So all of a sudden, here's a material that's in the same weight class, but without any of the environmental issues. Started testing it, researching it for a couple of years. We imported some material, did more extensive testing, and then decided this is something that should be in the States. And it's been used in Europe now going on 40 years. So just new to North America.
Were you the first to bring it to North America, Archie?
Yes. Yes, correct. For what we're doing, the dry process foam glass, correct.
Now, I know there are concerns about the integrity of it, or is this safe? Is this temporary bridge that's being supported by the recycled glass material, is this going to be safe? Like, how can you reassure folks?
Yeah, so we've been in the U.S., we've been making the material since 2017, and we've got it underneath roadways and highways up and down the East Coast. This is a temporary application, which probably accounts for maybe 2% of the projects that we do. Everything else that we do is, there permanently. So we're underneath a 10-acre apron at Philadelphia International Airport where they park the large jets on. We're underneath the on-ramp to I-95 at Girard Avenue.
So
And
this
this
could
goes.
withstand the traffic that travels on that part of the interstate by Cobman.
Correct, correct. Down in Virginia and Fredericksburg, the center lanes are on 15 feet of foam glass aggregate.
Oh, wow. So, Archie, you alluded to it earlier, but I want you to perhaps be a bit more descriptive. What is the advantage of this material over dirt or the normal gravel we see every day or some other alternative? Why did it fit this type of project where they're trying to get something up really quickly?
Yeah, so there's probably two key components to this specifically for what's going on at Cobman Avenue. The quickest way to open up 95 was to build that embankment, which is what they're doing, and open up lanes while they work on the permanent bridge. However, they could have brought in any type of fill, but in that same section where they needed underneath Cobman Avenue are two utilities. There's an 86-inch sewer main and I believe a 30-inch water main. So if you were to bring up 20 foot of fill in that area with those utilities, the potential for breaking the utility, crushing it under that weight, was the concern. So that leads you to an ultra lightweight material that now you can bring up 20 feet of that foam glass up to the road surface, which will end up feeling like only maybe 3 or 4 feet of soil and not put any of that stress on the utilities below. So that was the primary reason why they use it. It's why we get used on a lot of projects to take weight off of soft compressible soils or underground utilities. But the other thing, and we saw this on Friday, the material can be placed in much thicker lifts than traditional soils and has no effects by weather. So a lot of soils, if it's raining, you have to stop, let the material dry out. Foam glass has none of those issues. So even on Friday during that heavy rain event, the Buckley and Company were able to keep compacting material and bring it up. They weren't stopped at all because of the rain.
Right. So were you surprised at the speed of this rebuild so far? I mean, I am surprised.
I come from a construction background and I'm impressed. I don't want to say surprised. I'm impressed because, and the reason I make that distinction is it's the teamwork of everybody out there, right? The contractor's doing a great job, but the coordination with the state police, the city, I mean, I think the governor used the term all hands on deck. I mean, you can see that firsthand with everybody involved in that project. And I think what's great for Philadelphia, and I see it from my side, even just as an aggregate supplier, are the amount of calls you get from, let us know if we can help. What do you need? Like everybody's on board to get this thing going. So they're doing a great job and it is going up a lot faster than I believe anyone expected. But they're out there 24/7 and they're working the entire time, no doubt about it.
Well, you and all the folks involved have become the rock stars of the
Oh,
Delaware Valley this past 2 weeks.
yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us, Archie
I
Filsher.
appreciate that. Thank you
Absolutely,
so much.
absolutely. And we appreciate the time. We know you're busy right now. Shirley Min, thank
Thank
you
you.
for being with us today. We really appreciate
You're
your time.
welcome.
Hope you enjoyed it.
I had fun.
Okay, please come back.
I will if you got to invite me.
I just invited you now. We got more coming up on Studio 2, talking net zero.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Now, our next guest is trying to solve a puzzle. Now, this is not the type you do over a rainy weekend on your dining room table. This is a puzzle that will take decades and could determine the future of our planet. To stop the worst effects of climate change, we need to drastically reduce carbon emissions. We know that. The goal for many is something called net zero, which means basically we capture as much carbon as we emit. So can the U.S. do that by 2050? And if we did, what are the various paths that would get us there? What trade-offs would all of that entail? Those are the questions that Princeton University professor Jesse Jenkins spends his time pondering. He is a professor of energy systems and leads the Princeton Zero Lab, which tries to model or predict how different policies and technologies will impact our climate future. This is very big picture thinking, and he is going to walk us through some of his thinking today. Jesse Jenkins, welcome to Studio 2.
Avi, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for being here. And of course, we want to hear from you in the audience. Do you have questions about clean energy? How do you think about your carbon footprint? Do you drive an EV? Have solar on your roof? Maybe there's a carbon combating technology that confuses or intrigues you. I know there are many for me. Share your thoughts, 888-477-9499, or email us at studio2@whyy.org. All right, Jesse, as I was rambling there, I tried to very briefly describe what net zero means. And as soon as I think about this concept and this problem, my brain really starts to break. So can you explain for us what net zero emissions actually means? Was I anywhere in the ballpark there?
Yeah, I think you did pretty well. Net zero basically means that we've reached a point, we're still working on this, but we would in the future reach a point where the total impact of greenhouse gas emissions from human activities, whether that's, you know, transportation or heating or industry, is exactly canceled out by human-caused removal of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. That's the net part of net zero. So we're netting out any emissions with removals. That's the point where we basically stop digging ourselves a deeper hole when it comes to the impacts on global climate change. It's not going to stop climate change. There's a lot of impacts already baked into the system. But what we can do, basically how quickly we get to net zero will determine how much additional impacts we have in store. And we need to get there as fast as possible, because it's not the rate of emissions that drives climate change. It's actually the cumulative amount of carbon dioxide in particular that is up in the atmosphere. And so the path from here to net zero, it matters as much as the destination.
So if we are producing an amount, we're emitting an amount of carbon dioxide that is so small that's able to be absorbed, let's say, by the natural environment, trees and plants and whatnot. That's not net zero, or that is net zero? I'm trying to understand the concept before I go any deeper.
Yeah, that would be net zero. We can also augment those, you know, existing natural carbon sinks like wetlands and forests with other additional efforts called negative emissions technologies. They're all quite nascent today because there's not a lot of demand for this at the moment. But it could mean, you know, chemical means of removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, kind of scrubbing it out of the air and then storing it underground. That's called direct air capture. Or if we use, we grow biomass crops, or we take residues from agriculture, those plants absorb carbon dioxide when they grow. And if we can then separate that CO2 and store it, that's another means to reduce greenhouse gas emissions or pull carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So that'd be biomass-based pathways for negative emissions as well. So we can augment the natural stuff with some additional technology. But in any case, the sum of that has to equal any emissions that remain from, you know, hard to decarbonize activities that prove too challenging to eliminate directly.
So we've already listed a bunch of potential technologies and alluded to some paths. I mean, how do you begin to think about this problem? What are the categories of solutions here?
Well, it's also helpful to start with kind of where our greenhouse gas emissions come from now. And, you know, there's sort of a few big buckets to that. If you think about the sources directly, sort of the fuels and where they come from, most of the greenhouse gases come from transportation, power, so electric power, and industry. Agriculture is also an important source, and building, direct fuel consumption in buildings. But actually, a lot of that electricity goes into our buildings. So if you think about where we're consuming rather than what the sort of source of emissions is, the buildings part jumps to the higher end of the list there, you know, because we consume a lot of electricity in our homes and in businesses. Those emissions from electricity are kind of upstream, but are quite significant. So, you know, we have to start by basically tackling all of those major sources. We're making the most progress in electricity and transportation right now. We have been steadily reducing greenhouse gas emissions in the overall economy in the United States. They're down about 1 billion metric tons So about 15% or so. From our peak levels, we reached our peak emissions in the U.S. sometime between 2005 and 2007. And so we've reduced emissions from about 7 billion tons to about 6, a little below 6 over that decade or last decade or so. And fortunately, thanks to new laws passed by the last Congress, particularly the Inflation Reduction Act, which kind of puts clean energy on sale for the whole country by subsidizing the cost of adoption of all sorts of clean energy solutions, we're likely to now double that pace of decarbonization that we saw over the last decade, cutting emissions by about 4% per year over the next 10 years or so. So that's good progress. It's still a bit shy of the pace that we would want to be on, though, if we're going to get to net zero by 2050 and get to a goal that President Biden set for 2030, which is to cut emissions to half of our peak levels by the end of the decade. That would require getting to about 6% per year pace of carbon reduction, up from the 4% that we're projecting now. So we've made a lot of progress, but still more work to be done to get on the pathway to net zero.
One of the things that overwhelms me when I begin to think about this topic is how do we divide our efforts between investing in things that work right now, that we know reduce emissions right now, versus investing in ideas that could be transformative and may work in the future, but we're just not sure. Sort of this dichotomy between doing and dreaming. So how do you approach that question? Like, just step back. How do you think about that dichotomy?
It's a great question. And it's one, you know, a lot of folks have grappled with for a long time in the policy sphere. I mean, my approach to this is essentially, you know, we only get one shot at this, right? And we really have the whole planet at stake, right? We get really the next few decades to try to get ourselves to net zero and get a hold of this challenge. If we fail to do that, then we're going to be locking in a significant amount of suffering and impacts on human and non-human lives all over the planet. And so this is our one shot. And so if you're, you know, thinking about it from that perspective, you really want to be risk averse, right? We want to avoid the chances of failure. And so what that means is simultaneously deploying stuff that we know works now, trying to figure out how fast we can scale it up, whether that's wind or solar power, heat pumps for our homes, electric vehicles, you know, for transportation. Those are technologies that we have invested in the past when they used to be kind of expensive niche technologies. And we supported them with public policy so that they would grow and get more mature, that we would drive down costs through steady innovation and economies of scale in manufacturing and supply chains, you know, learning by doing, where we just get progressively better at building these things. All that's driven down the cost of those technologies really dramatically. I think a lot of people don't appreciate that we've cut the cost of electric vehicle batteries and solar power by about 90% since 2010. So it's about one tenth the cost as it was a decade ago or so. And wind power has come down by about two thirds in cost due to that policy support. So now they're ready to scale to have a huge impact. The bulk of the emissions reductions we'll see over the next decade are going to come from those technologies. And they're going to be stars of the show on through 2030 or 2050, too. At the same time, they can't get us all the way to net zero on their own. And so we need to be taking as many shots on goal as we can, you know, deploying the whole range of possible technologies that are more immature now. But if we devote the same support to them now as we did to wind and solar and batteries a decade ago, then by the 2030s and 2040s, they'll be ready for prime time as well. And not every one of those technologies is probably going to work out as planned. You know, they might not all hit 90% emissions or 90% cost declines over the decade. But if, you know, enough of them work, then we'll have the full toolkit that we need to reach net zero. So we got to walk and chew gum at the same time, deploy what we know works, but simultaneously expand our toolkit over the next decade.
Can you give me an example of a technology that you think could be in the toolkit and is sort of close enough that it's worth plowing some dollars and time into right now versus something that you consider just too blue sky, even though it might work in theory, just too blue sky, too far off to be worth our time?
Yeah, there's quite a lot of options. And actually, fortunately, we are seeing quite a significant amount of both public policy support from both the bipartisan infrastructure law that passed last Congress and the Inflation Reduction Act, as well as a lot of venture capital and private sector investment going into these solutions. So I'm a lot more optimistic now that we're going to see these technologies scale than I was, you know, 5 years ago or 4 years ago. But, you know, we'll take something like advanced geothermal or advanced nuclear power or carbon capture and storage for industrial processes or power plants, or the production of hydrogen from clean sources, all of those are likely to be critical tools in the toolkit going forward. And, you know, they're all at the point where the first kind of commercial scale projects, the really, you know, large industrial scale projects for each of those technologies is going to get built over the next, you know, 2 to 5 years.
So we're already dipping our toe in those waters, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And then we'll really get to see, you know, how do they actually work? How far are we from where we want to be? You know, how far do we need to go from those first commercial projects to the mature sectors that we want to have in the 2030s? You know, maybe some of them won't work as planned either. They'll, you know, we'll encounter more technical challenges than we thought, or they just simply be far more expensive than we thought. And that's also important learning, right? I mean, if you think about this as like an innovation challenge, failure is often a very good way to learn and to innovate too, because it focuses you on the challenges ahead that you need to solve, and also can help you cut your losses and, you know, refocus your efforts on things that are working better. So it's really kind of a portfolio strategy approach that we need to pursue with these novel technologies. I can't count on any single one of them working, but there's enough of them that we're fielding that I'm pretty confident we're going to have a much better toolkit, you know, a few years from now.
We're talking about the road to net zero with Jesse Jenkins, professor of energy systems at Princeton University, where he leads the Zero Lab. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. Have an email here from Peter. How do you see pricing carbon, specifically a carbon fee and dividend policy, as being a major lever in getting us to net zero? And if I could just piggyback off that a little bit, I'm curious more generally where you see government intervention being helpful in the next 5 to 10 years versus where you think it's sort of not necessary. But if you wouldn't mind addressing Peter's question first.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, we're not going to really see a dramatic shift towards cleaner energy options unless we can shift the economic calculus for the millions of individual decisions that, you know, you and I make about what we're going to buy, how we're going to heat our home, how we're going to drive to work, or that businesses are making about how to structure their business decisions, right? Whether that's like a fleet manager for Avis or Amazon or whoever, you know, thinking about what vehicles to stock, or a, you know, a purchasing manager for a big business thinking about what they're going to do. All those decisions, we really need to tilt towards the clean side of the equation and away from incumbent, you know, dirty fossil energy technologies. And so there's two ways to do that, right? You can either make the fossil energy more expensive, and that's what carbon pricing aims to do. We can either kind of put a limit on the total amount of greenhouse gases. That'll create a scarcity for the ability to continue to pollute. Those are, you know, permits for greenhouse gases. That'll drive a kind of a cost to into the market for pollution. That's an approach that California and Washington State and the European Union have taken to capping greenhouse gas emissions. Also the power sector in New Jersey and many other mid-Atlantic and Northeast states has done that. And then the other approach would be to just directly tax it. That's the approach that you know, Norway and Sweden and Switzerland and a few other countries have taken to just, you know, say, hey, we're gonna put a price on carbon pollution. So that's one option. It's been used, as I mentioned, in a few different places. You know, I don't think it takes a political scientist to realize that like the political challenge of raising energy costs by pricing in carbon is quite difficult, you know, for a politician to propose that we're going to increase your energy costs for businesses and for households and for everybody else. That was particularly true in the context of rapid inflation, which is where we were, you know, when Congress was considering policy last year and, you know, still are today. And so in that context, and you know, in general, there's another strategy, which is you can make the clean energy stuff cheaper, right? And we can do that initially with subsidies, tax credits, grants, rebates, you know, preferential loans or loan guarantees that lower the effective cost of clean energy options. And that's the approach that Congress took last year. It's an approach that many states have taken in their policies as well. And so we basically put clean energy on sale. So the subsidies in the Inflation Reduction Act touch on pretty much every solution in the toolkit, whether it's you know, heat pumps and energy efficiency upgrades for your homes or businesses, electric vehicles for, again, both personal vehicles and business, you know, heavy duty and medium duty trucks and rental fleets and other things. All sources of clean electricity, clean hydrogen, carbon capture, all of these things are subsidized by the Inflation Reduction Act. And it effectively cuts the cost by somewhere between 10 and 50% for all of those technologies, depending on the subsidy. So that's the other approach. We just put our thumb on the scale for the clean stuff and push it down. And you know, that's likely to be much more politically popular and durable to basically say we're going to tax corporations who haven't been paying, you know, minimum taxes and tax cheats who have been evading their taxes. That's how we paid for the Inflation Reduction Act. And we're going to use that money to lower the cost of clean energy adoption for everyone. That in my view, is a much more politically viable and durable solution. And it's what Congress did in the last session. And so that's where we are now. And I think that's a really promising way to move forward.
Listener Abe sent an email, wants to hear you, Jesse, talk about the best practices for better storing clean energy solutions for wind and solar. Are you able to take that one?
Sure. Yeah, this is something that we've researched a lot in our group here at Princeton. You know, there are a whole range of energy technologies for storage, for electric power storage. You know, the most promising one is lithium ion batteries, which are the same technology that are inside electric vehicles. And the reason that it has become such a good option for grid scale storage is because we actually need a couple orders of magnitude more batteries for EVs than we do on the grid. And so grid scale lithium ion batteries are, you know, sort of coasting in the draft of the much bigger demand for batteries for electric vehicles. And so we get these huge economies of scale, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of investment by industry and supply chains and improvements in technology to make better and cheaper EVs. And then we get to just use those batteries in the power sector, too, for storage. So we're starting to see, you know, this take off, really hit an inflection point, battery storage, you know, with where we're deploying, you know, gigawatts of batteries, which is, you know, the equivalent of a nuclear reactor worth of power, you know, in many different markets all over the United States and elsewhere. Now, that's really good for like, you know, 4 to 8 hours of storage, maybe 4 to 6 hours of battery storage. And so what we're typically doing right now with those batteries is, say, taking solar power output in the middle of the day while most people are at work, and we maybe have an excess of solar output, and then shifting it to the time when everybody comes home, you know, plugs in their EVs, turns on the stove, you know, starts to cool or heat their homes for the evening. And we get this peak in demand for electricity that usually hits between, you know, 6 and 8 p.m. And so we can move that solar output or wind output from the morning or overnight, you know, and discharge batteries for 4 hours or so in the evening. And that does a really good job of helping level out demand and make better use of wind and solar. There's a limit to how far we can go with those short duration batteries, though. And so there's a whole bunch of innovative technologies that pursue thermal storage options, chemical, mechanical, all different ways to store energy up. The key to all of those is they have to be really cheap for the energy storage medium, because we got to store a lot of energy and hold on to it for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And we use those batteries less often. So they just have to be cheap to pay off.
Can I ask you real quick, Jesse, we have 10 seconds. Are you optimistic?
I am optimistic. I mean, this is a huge challenge, but it's also somewhat exciting. I mean, we are going to rebuild how we make and use energy across the economy and the process. We're going to shift to cleaner energy, and we're going to create a lot of economic opportunity at the same time.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We just heard from Jesse Jenkins, professor of energy systems at Princeton University and lead of the Zero Lab. Thank him so much for his time. Coming up, we're going to hear from poet Jane Wong about her new book. It's all about growing up in the 80s in a Chinese restaurant in Atlantic City, New Jersey. She details her father's gambling addiction, her mom's love of advice giving, and what girlhood was like as the child of immigrants. The memoir is titled Meet Me Tonight in Atlantic City, and she recently spoke with my co-host, Cherry Gregg.
Jane Wong, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to chat with you, Cherry.
Yes, me too. And congratulations on your memoir. It was vivid, memorable, and I could conjure visions, sounds, and even smells.
Thank you. I always joke around about being a restaurant baby. This idea of the restaurant being my house is just like full of like delicious snacks and food and conversation. So it means a lot that you enjoyed it.
That's a perfect place to start. I mean, your family came from China to the United States. You were born in the early 80s in New Jersey, grew up along the shore. Talk about what it was like growing up a restaurant baby near such a popular Vice city.
Yeah, so I grew up in a little Chinese American takeout restaurant. I spent all of my time there at the restaurant, including doing all the chores that you can imagine. And my father, he gambled a lot during that time period. Sometimes he would disappear from work for 2 weeks, you know, in Atlantic City. And so I spent a lot of my childhood actually also in Atlantic City and kind of going with him to the casinos where my mom and my brother and I would kind of hang out at the boardwalk while he gambled.
And that's a perfect pivot because I want you to read an excerpt from the book.
Yeah, I'm happy to read. Thank you so much. When we drive home from Atlantic City together, my father would glow over his winnings. He'd flail an arm back in that poorly won BMW and toss a couple of $20 bills at us. Liar, my mother would say, staring out the window. You lost. You always lose. The new leather burns our thighs as we watch the parkway smokestacks grow exponentially. She was right. My father always lost in the end.
Wow, that was a very powerful summary, I think. How did you see gambling growing up? And when did you realize the hold that it had over your father specifically, and then generally over many people within your own community?
It really began in the restaurant and at our home and in the homes of my father's friends where he would hold kind of these mahjong gambling circles. And so when it kind of moved into Atlantic City, when it moved to larger spaces, casinos, the stakes were higher and the debts kind of piled up and up and up. As a kid, I certainly wanted so badly to be a part of it, to be honest. I was so curious about those mahjong tiles. I would think, you know, to myself, like, I just want to play with them. They look like toys, really, like little blocks. Mm-hmm. And I would play with them. I would actually build little cities with the blocks. And I remember my father would just kind of knock them over and would be like, this is not a toy. This is daddy's stuff. Don't touch it. You know, my father isn't in my life, and I still miss him, and I still hope for reconciliation, you know? I think that was the hardest part about writing this book, was really trying to also create a, you know, tender portrait of him, too. A lot of these casino buses pick up in Chinatowns across the U.S., so I certainly see it as tied to something larger here in terms of targeting low-income immigrant families.
I want to take you to the beginning of the book. It starts with an essay that describes a low point in your life where your mother feeds you dragon fruit on a knife. Can you talk about this scene and sort of the tender yet tough type of love and advice that your mom seemed to give you throughout your life?
This book is in many ways a love letter to her. And that opening scene, that toughness, that actual moment of me eating fruit off her knife is a kind of moment where she is trying so badly to nourish me in ways that is not necessarily saying, like, I love you. But, you know, cut fruit is such a demonstration of that love and that resilience and that caretaking. And so she's feeding me dragon fruit at the start of the book and telling me to be strong. But then I realized strength is not so much a moment of, you know, just kind of like putting up with everything that is difficult that's coming at you in life, but it's actually also about like slowing down and being in community and asking for help when you need it. And my mom kind of like feeding me in that moment is a pause where, you know, I kind of needed her help. And so I always think about fruit as this reminder that there's still sweetness in this world. And she's such a great character in the book, but obviously she's real. So I been joking around that I'm like the knockoff brand cereal version of her, you know, like mm-hmm. I want to be her so much. But yes.
You're most known for your poetry, and this is your debut memoir. And it's written in this very non-linear fashion. And you even have these parts called WongMom.com that are this type of advice from your mother. What inspired the structure of your book? And you mentioned briefly that it was a love letter.
Yes, it is exactly that. There's a lot of rage and anger in the book, but there's so much love and tenderness and care and resilience too. Ultimately, I really wanted to also create a space that felt almost like a future space, because I kept thinking that memoir is so tied to the past. We think about the word memoir tied to the word memory, of course. And I really wanted to think about, like, what can happen in a memoir where a future space exists. And that's where I created this character, WongMom.com, who is kind of like a futuristic character mm. where she exists in the internet, and people will like type in their questions, and WongMom.com, my mom that lives in the internet, will answer them with advice. I'm actually going to make her real. Wow. I did buy the domain, and we're in the works of making her not necessarily like AI, but that you'll be able to ask a question and you'll get a line from the memoir to answer your question. So I certainly...
That is really cool.
Right? I think it's going to be pretty fun.
So your book is titled Meet Me Tonight in Atlantic City. It's named after Bruce Springsteen's song. And the song is actually referenced in the book. Explain why this was the perfect title for your memoir.
It is a pretty melancholy song. It's definitely a song that's difficult and challenging in terms of the storytelling and, you know, what it means to desire something that's already lost and that one day it's going to come back, right? There's that line, you know, everything dies, maybe that's a fact. Maybe everything that dies someday comes back. And I think that was the perfect title for the book because I do long for, I think, like a certain part of my childhood, you know, my father to return to me, and for so many of, you know, the things that I've lost and the people I've lost to return to me. And so there's a lot of longing, I think, in that song that really mirrors the mood of the book, too. But I'm always a Jersey girl at heart.
Tired of coming out on this losing end. And hey, there is the song we are talking about, and that was Jane Wong, author of Meet Me Tonight in Atlantic City, talking with our own Cherry Gregg, who was no one's knockoff brand cereal. Many thanks to Shirley Min for her wonderful additions at the top of the hour. And of course, as always, we thank today's producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Charlie Kyer is our engineer from Studio 2 in WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Talk to you tomorrow.